Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bookomi podcast, original, memorable insights, Omi, from the most wanted minds across business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode, we meet the UK's most prominent and influential climate change campaigner, who gives us 10 years, starting in 2021, to save humankind from a risk far greater than COVID-19.
The chance must be that we now use this COVID-19 crisis to rebuild our economies in ways that simultaneously address the climate emergency. That is the big test, and it starts immediately. As soon as governments put out those recovery packages, everything in those packages has got to help us address the climate emergency.
Jonathan Porritt was the director of Friends of the Earth and co-chair of the Green Party in the 80s, co-founded the Forum for the Future in the 90s, and in the noughties he received a CBE for services to environmental protection and was chair of the UK Sustainable Development Commission, advising government ministers on climate change. Today, he's the Chancellor of Keele University, where he's been in office since 2012. His new book, Hope in Hell, is a rallying call to arms for everyone to change the narrative of what he calls a horror story of runaway climate change. Jonathan, welcome to the Bookomi podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be taking part.
Not the brightest and bounciest of intros, really. You must get sick of being introduced in such grave terms.
Well, it is a bit difficult dealing with this whole climate emergency and what it means to people. And there's no doubt that as the science has just got firmer and firmer and the evidence of the impacts of climate change have suddenly emerged all around us in the last 4 or 5 years, it's very difficult to be upbeat about all that because it's not an upbeat story. It's a story of political neglect and refusal to face reality and so on. So the point of the book really was to say, don't turn away from any of that. It's what it is. It is happening, and it is happening faster and more furiously than we thought it could. Don't turn away from that, but do get to grips with the fact that it's not too late still to address it. And that's essentially the balance that I was trying to work on in the book, was to get these two things together.
Well, the sun's shining today. It looks like it is where you are. And so starting on a positive note, part one of Hope in Hell is called Reasons to be Cheerful. And when it seems that we missed the boat to do something effective in the 80s when Margaret Thatcher was in power, what reasons are left to be cheerful today? Have we not gone through them all?
No. Nope, there are still really good reasons to be cheerful about this, or at least to be hopeful about our ability to get it sorted. And we can start with the stuff we do know a lot about already, which is the technology of low carbon prosperity. So the transition from fossil fuels to renewables and storage is moving at scale and at pace, far faster than anybody thought. Cost curves continue to come down. I mean, essentially, no one's going to be able to compete with renewables plus storage plus energy efficiency. None of the fossil fuel alternatives can compete. So we have to celebrate the technology, because without that, I tell you, we wouldn't have a hope in hell, okay? But we have got a hope in hell still. The second thing that people are less well informed about is what are now called nature-based solutions to climate change. And that means just healing our natural world, going back and thinking about soil quality, protecting our forests, restoring degraded ecosystems, whatever it might be. This is vast and actually would make a massive difference to biodiversity and to climate. The third thing that I'm really big on is the kind of incredible injection of energy that has come from young people into the climate debate, which has been amazing. And we don't feel that right now because, of course, it's been lost through the COVID crisis. It's very hard for young people's organizations to maintain that momentum. They're still there. They're still doing their good stuff, but it's not the same thing. It's really difficult. All of that plus support from business, investors. I've even touched on the reality of the world's big faith organizations getting behind this. This is all stuff to feel good about, because it continues to move at pace and it continues to make a big difference. But we'll come on to why all of that isn't enough, because if it had been enough, we would have got it sorted by now. But the truth is that alone is not enough because of the politics of it.
Well, let's talk politics for a while. Well, for a second, because that's a theme that, I mean, that's something that punches through the book all the way through, and it punctuates it. It's your adherence to keeping politics center stage and not making this an issue that is just of hearts and minds or business or retail, that politics is right at the heart of it. We're in the middle of dealing with a pandemic right now, caused by a disease that some scientists saw on the horizon years ago. Does this make us more or less likely to look beyond clear and present dangers? Are we learning at the moment to see beyond just clear and present dangers of infection, say, to the future, to the current threat of climate change? Is what I'm trying to say, in a very long-winded way, Jonathan, sorry, is it helping to drive a hope in hell that we're going through hell at the moment?
Yeah, nicely put. Well, I am paradoxically more hopeful about addressing the climate emergency because of the COVID-19, the coronavirus crisis. Because I think people have suddenly realized just how precarious our lives are. They've watched what happens when governments actually decide that it requires massive intervention to help sort things out. And we've learned a lot about the stupidity of our carbon intensive, our high emitting lifestyles in terms of aviation, changes in our cities, our ability to reconnect with nature. We've kind of picked up a lot of stuff about how we could be living better anyway. So my sense of it is that we, as we emerge from the coronavirus crisis, we've got a chance to do it in a way that simultaneously addresses the climate emergency. And that's what the kind of airwaves are full of at the moment. Scientists, economists, a lot of politicians themselves, commentators, expert organizations are all saying we are going to have to put a lot of money into overcoming the consequences of the COVID-19 crisis. We have to do it in a way that simultaneously gets to grips with the climate emergency. And that's becoming the rallying cry for everybody now, trying to think of the best kind of recovery from this situation today. That for me is why, paradoxically, it's a bit more hopeful now than it used to be before the crisis. But the hope must be that this shock to our system, which is massive, not just the health shock, but the economic shock, which will now unravel for years to come, the shock to the system has been so great that people have had to sit up and think, whoa, our way of life wasn't quite as secure as we thought it was. And there are things going on that we're not aware of. And especially if we start linking the origins of COVID-19 back to our destruction of the natural world, which is a very clear link. And I think will come out in the sort of retrospective analysis of how this happened. But it is a classic example of what they call the tragedy of the horizon. We're doing everything now because it's short term, in our faces, massively painful, lives disrupted all over the world. Climate change has been an emerging reality for politicians for decades, literally for decades. But because it's a far horizon issue, not a near horizon issue, they have always had excuses and pretexts to put off the actions that were needed. Now, it's getting closer and closer. The truth is the world is already seeing the impacts of accelerating climate change in real time now all over the world. So the chance must be that we now use this COVID-19 crisis to rebuild our economies in ways that simultaneously address the climate emergency. That is the big test, and it starts immediately. As soon as governments put out those recovery packages, everything in those packages has got to help us address the climate emergency.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's an opportunity to reset upon a new green future, a green deal permeating the present day. But how do you navigate the immediate issues of survival when the economy will be front and center stage? It might seem a luxury to be sustainable.
People have often sort of mentioned that connection, which has always baffled me, to be honest, but you are right. The principal obligation of governments now is to restore purchasing power, to get the economy moving again. So what we've got to find are those interventions by government that makes it possible to create new jobs, get people back into work, do some of the things that need doing around our infrastructure and so on, and simultaneously do the right thing for the climate. So let me give you just one example. There are a lot of examples in the book, but the one I'm really focused on, for the last 20 years, we've known that we have to do something really dramatic about restoring the very poor housing quality in the UK. I mean, literally, the lives of millions of people are blighted by poor housing stock, and it causes huge health problems as well as anything else. So the obvious thing is to say, okay, we're going to have a national home recovery program, energy efficiency program in our homes and other buildings for the next 5 years, which will create thousands, tens of thousands of jobs during the course of that time as we put right this terrible deficit in housing quality in the UK. Fuel poverty is an issue that affects literally millions of people in this country. So if the government gets smart and sort of says, you know what, we've got to sort a lot of these things out anyway, we've got to do it for climate reasons, boy, is it going to be a big economic multiplier, skills multiplier in each constituency, go after these new kind of opportunities. Then you've got, sorry to be cliched about it, but you have got a real win-win. And there are dozens of things that we could be doing along those lines.
Scientists are much more important, much higher profile than they've ever been in public life and in politics. Has this helped to shift perspective on existential threats in politics and silence what you call the noisy ideologues forever? Or have the government messed it up in your opinion by seemingly not following scientific advice when it suits them?
It's been good to see how scientists have been center stage in this, because different countries have reflected that science in different ways. There's no one path to addressing the coronavirus crisis, but there's no doubt that the general public has been reminded of the influence, the critical influence of good science mediated well in ways that help people understand the nature of the response that we need. For me, that's restored science to its rightful place. Politicians can't deal with these things out of some kind of scientific vacuum. Will that spill over and ensure that governments now listen to their climate scientists in ways they haven't listened before? Boy, I certainly hope so, because the voice from scientists has been absolutely unambiguous, loud and clear for the last 15 years, to be honest, muddled and confused by what I did refer to as the noisy ideologues, the people who have no scientific understanding of this stuff at all, certainly not grounded in the science, but managed to obscure, to confuse, to question, and therefore cause people to doubt whether or not the science was 100% robust. There's no disputing that now. There's just no disputing it. So we need that voice of science now on climate to be as clear and influential as it has been on a public health crisis.
The science now is about how we deal with the situation, isn't it? And geoengineering, new ways of sustainable government, sustainable economies. I think it's also humanized science and scientists for people, hasn't it? I've spoken to a few epidemiologists in the last few weeks, and they've said it's really interesting how people didn't realize that scientists, they're constantly experimenting. So the whole point of being in the middle of a pandemic is, you know, you only have your empirical evidence to the current point, you know, where you are now. When the future is uncertain, we need scientists to test.
Absolutely. And that's going to be absolutely crucial with the climate emergency. I do make the claim that we've got tons of solutions to the climate emergency already with us, proven, ready to go, to be deployed at a much bigger scale, investable propositions. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But there are a lot of big question marks still that have to be answered. So one huge area which causes real difficulties for environmentalists is we are going to have to take a lot of the CO2 that we put into the atmosphere back out of the atmosphere. We've got to get billions of tons of CO2 back out of the atmosphere to prevent this runaway climate change phenomenon. Now, what is the best way of doing that? And that's where science is going to be absolutely critical, because there are a lot of people who say, well, we can do it by all sorts of fancy things, putting reflecting mirrors up in space, spraying aerosols in the upper atmosphere, etc., etc. And there are other people who say, you have got to be joking. We have got to do this via what I referred to as nature-based solutions, bringing that CO2 back into our ecosystems, back into soil, into biomass, into forests, into degraded mangrove swamps, into wetlands, peat bogs, all of these places that act as what are called sinks for CO2. But we've depleted those sinks so seriously that we've made the problem even worse. Now we've got to restore all of that. That's the nature-based approach rather than anything else. The voice of science in that, experts in those fields, all those different fields are going to be critical, because we've got to do this at scale and we've got to do it at a reasonable cost, because otherwise the implications for our global economy could be even worse than the implications of COVID-19.
And you also call for, so you're calling for radical reductions in carbon emissions, the recarbonizing, is that a word?
Yep.
Recarbonization.
It's my word, Richard.
Thank you for sharing it with me. Of forest plant life sinks, like you say. But also thirdly, and crucially, and I think most controversially today, civil disobedience, or NVDA, non-violent direct action, which is possibly the most radical in terms of people's acceptance of change. Where does that come from? And does that go back to your days at Friends of the Earth and the experiences you've had over the years and working in government as well, where you finally decided that without non-violent direct action, nothing happens?
It goes right back to the time I joined the Green Party in 1974. And acceptance of the need for non-violent direct action is in the founding principles of the Green Party. So it's always been part of my understanding that sometimes one has to make use of a very different political device from simply being party to and part of a thriving democracy. And I've come to that conclusion now, Richard, just because I can't see the politicians doing what they need to do fast enough without a massive amount of additional political pressure. And 2019 taught us two things. We saw the emergence of Extinction Rebellion, of XR, which did move the system. There's no question about that. And we saw the emergence of young people in such a way that it just summoned up a different kind of energy. By the end of 2019, there'd been 7 million young people on the streets of different cities around the world, all of whom had been energized in that way in just 1 year. It's the most amazing social movement that the world has ever seen, in fact. So for me, I know that to do justice to that young energy, we are going to have to put far more pressure on our politicians, far more pressure. And part of that will be nonviolent direct action, will be civil disobedience. And I do a chapter in the book, as you know, looking at how cases of civil disobedience has been absolutely necessary to move the needle politically in the past, where people have had to take that kind of direct action just to inject more pressure into the system. So I don't welcome this. I wish we had far-sighted, intelligent, smart politicians who could do this on behalf of all their constituents and interested parties to date, as well as on behalf of future generations. But look, we've been trying to get them to do this by every means possible for decades. So we're going to have to change the nature of that pressure point, basically.
You draw a really interesting comparison in history between the climate change campaign and change with the abolition of slavery and the lengths that people had to go to change society, change the way of thinking, how economics, morality, the rights of man were brought into question to prevent what we now consider to be just part of everyday life, of something, you know, and accepting a moral right that somebody shouldn't be enslaved. What did we learn from that campaign about human nature, and has human nature changed since the 17th and 18th centuries? The emancipation of women, universal suffrage, Emily Pankhurst, people who've given their lives, who've acted disobediently in civil life. But has human nature changed at all since then? Are people going to have to lose their lives? Well, many have already, in order to bring the hope to the front of the discussion and get people to think more seriously about climate change?
I think history tells us pretty clearly that not many of the really good things that matter in our lives today happened without a fight. And the reason for that is deep down politics. Most people in positions of influence and power want to hang on to what it was that got them there in the first place. It's called the incumbency syndrome. They're the incumbents in the system. They want to stay hanging on to that. And of course, these days, it's a joint incumbency with a very large number of big businesses fighting for their continuing influence. I only need mention big oil, for instance, to demonstrate that. Hand in glove with governments to kind of stick with a high carbon intensive economy of the kind that we have now. So that incumbency is going to have to be rooted out. And that is going to require a different kind of political will, a different kind of readiness on the part of the general public to support the obvious solutions, which won't diminish their quality of life one bit, by the way, because we will still be able to rely on different energy sources, different systems, to provide the goods and services that society needs. So it's not that they're going to in any way be impoverished or lack some of the critical things they need today, but it means a very radical transformation along the way. So has human nature changed? I think I've subscribed to the view that human nature is basically good, and that if we can provide the upbringing and education and context for young people, people grow up wanting to be on the right side of things, to be good for other people, to be good for their community, for their family, and so on. And actually, the COVID-19 crisis has really demonstrated that in the most extraordinary way. But we don't need another disaster to be our better selves. What we need is smart politicians who will allow us to be our better selves by putting in place the kind of policy prescriptions that we need. That's where the fight is going to be.
I interviewed Rutger Bregman the other day
for
his book, A Hopeful History, and a lot of what you're saying chimes with his thesis and his belief in the good nature of people and our cooperation, our ability to collaborate, and the fact that we've almost forgotten how to do that because, to coin that phrase, we've been a bit enslaved to following a certain way and believing that we are cynical and that we are a cruel species as opposed to a kind species. And I think that's what people find confusing at the moment. We're living through an age of populism. We're living through an age where the word people to refer to the populace and a public opinion is being used and misused in equal measure. Mm. And generally people are confused because when you say, oh, somebody is a populist, historically we kind of think that was a good thing, being popular. Do you think the people in power at the moment who are affecting great change, we're going through huge upheavals in the last 3 or 4 years, and with that change might come the kind of awareness and realization that things have to be done about viruses, about the climate, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, terrorism, etc. But is it the change you want to see then that you've wanted to see for the last 30 years? Is all change good?
No, definitely not. But you're right about this populism sort of conundrum. It is really problematic. And as you know, I devoted a whole chapter in the book to democracy and to the importance of keeping our democracies really vibrant, healthy, fit for this very troubled age. There are some people who are so despairing about our ability to deal with something like the climate emergency that they've already decided it can't be done democratically. Well, I am not one of those. We absolutely have to do this through the exercise of all our democratic institutions and functions and powers. So I am worried about a particular pattern of populist politics today, which you can see all around the world, you know, not just in America, but in Brazil, in Russia, in the Philippines, in Turkey, where you've got these very so-called charismatic alpha males who are using all of their power to bring in policies that don't actually help people at all, but reinforce their own elite positions in society. Yes, I am really worried about that. And that will make it more problematic to bring forward intelligent global interventions on climate change, because this has to be done globally. You know, as I say, a molecule of CO2 is a molecule of CO2. It doesn't matter whether it comes from Boston or Bangladesh or Bermuda or whatever. It doesn't make any difference. It's the same thing chemically, has the same effect in the atmosphere. So this has to be done globally. There is nowhere you can hide away from the impacts of climate change. Nowhere. And even some of the rich billionaires that thought they could go and take refuge in far-flung places are suddenly beginning to realize that even their money isn't going to buy them that exemption. So that sort of politics worries me enormously, which is why it's to the point that I know a lot of climate campaigners will be nervous. I say defense of our democracy is as critical a part of your climate campaigning as being out there making the case for low carbon prosperity.
Because the truth matters, and telling the truth matters, and it has mattered over the years. And when the truth fails, or when truth is a casualty, there's that brilliant quote you give of Hannah Arendt on the origins of totalitarianism.
Yeah.
That when the gap between reality and fantasy is blurred, and when the truth and fake news blur the truth, people are more susceptible to totalitarianism. Yeah. And she was writing that in 1951. So we haven't learned a lot since then. And these things happen in waves, don't they? So there is that conundrum. I've noticed it where with language and the language being used recently, when you see elites attacking what they call elites.
Yeah.
When, and it's as if you can just throw that word around, and it almost sticks in my throat when I don't want to use it, because it's almost been abused or made redundant, the word. We've got to find a new word for people who are elites but call other people elites. The super elites.
Well, indeed.
The uber elites.
Yeah, I refer to this this caucus of super high net worth individuals who often use that wealth to secure their positions to the detriment of everybody else, and indeed to the detriment of the whole global economy. I mean, people will be surprised by this, but you know, I spent quite a bit of time in the book talking about tax evasion and tax avoidance, because these are billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars that are being sucked out of the system, which don't do anything good for society. They don't allow us to rebuild our broken down infrastructure, to put in place, for instance, proper contingency planning against future pandemics, which we're going to get for sure, to build up our health and social care systems. All of these really critical defenses of what makes society good are weakened by letting the super wealthy continue to enrich themselves to the detriment of society at large. So again, that may not be everybody's cup of tea who see themselves as climate campaigners, but that's the point. You've got to get to grips with these critical dysfunctionalities in the system that actually have stopped politicians doing what they should have done.
At least COVID has shown how a threat can occur on a global level, and it's made people who weren't maybe aware of where China is, or Wuhan is, or what happens in different cultures across the whole globe, has brought people together in a way. So finally, on a point of, I want to end on a note of optimism and hope, but I actually find talking about this quite optimistic, because especially when we're stuck in our bubbles at the moment, be they political bubbles or domestic bubbles, you can forget, you know, we can't help but watch the news and social media, and you can feel your mood going down again and thinking, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to hell in a handcart now, because is this what to expect of politicians and what to expect of each other? And then when you start talking to people again and actually discussing it, you realize that there are some hope, and you see it in the eyes of your kids, and you see it in the eyes of young people, as long as they don't grow cynical. So Greta Thunberg, is she the exception to the rule, or is she the symbol of everything that's good about the future?
I make no bones about the fact that the emergence of Greta in our lives in the back end of 2018 and 2019 was one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen. And as a kind of expression of leadership and inspiration for young people as well as for all the rest of us, I think it's been massively important. And I don't think that'll blow away. I think as soon as we can start bringing the politics of climate change back into the foreground, it's in the background at the moment, then that kind of example and young people's energy in general. So I have spent a lot of time in the last year working with young people's organizations and trying to work out what the climate youth movement is all about and how can oldies like me, how can I help them? Because, you know, it's difficult for some of us who've been in the trenches for a very long time to think that we can conjure up new stuff necessarily, but this is a different kind of energy. So I am very empowered by that personally. And one of the things I touch on in the book is what I call this intergenerational solidarity. There was a magic moment just before Christmas when Greta Thunberg was one of those occasional editors on the Today program, and she was interviewing David Attenborough. There's Greta Thunberg, 17, David Attenborough, 92, whatever he was. And there was something utterly priceless in that sense of between these two generations, young people today and older people now, who've, you know, often had very reasonably good lives, not obviously for everybody, but good lives. We have an opportunity to combine intergenerational forces to make the system change faster than it wants to do. And I'm completely dedicated to that now. That's where I think my usefulness can play out over however many more decades of campaigning I've got to go, basically.
Well, Jonathan, the fact that you've got a hope in hell has given me a hope in hell. Thank you. Thank you for writing the book and thank you for talking to me today.
Real pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Have a lovely day.
Thanks, Rich.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jonathan Porritt's book, Hope in Hell, Confronting the Climate Emergency, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new non-fiction, sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bookomi.com. From July, Bookomi members can register to take part in our podcast recordings, and getting the email will tell you who we've got coming up. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bookomi podcast, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify and Google audio platforms. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe, low carbon and vote for the future of the planet. Bye for now.